This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. We start at home, we go overseas. War, the common economic thread. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, 10 March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with a tale of two numbers, one of which you have surely seen or heard by this point, the other of which perhaps not. Number one is 7.9%. That is the February year-on-year headline consumer price index. Inflation, as you know, the highest it's been since Ronald Reagan was in his first term. We have gone over, I do believe, the fundamental causes these past several months: supply, demand, energy, cars. We know the why of this thing, is what I'm saying. What's becoming more clear the longer inflation lasts are the effects, which is where number two comes in. 5.1%, that's the increase in private sector average hourly wages last month over February 2021. And you do the math on this, just doesn't add up, right? Prices up 7.9%, paychecks up 5.1%. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra gets us going with that gap.
Barrett Yue is a manager at a coffee shop in Boston, and she recently got a promotion and pay bump from $14.75 to $15.75 an hour.
It's definitely on the stingy side.
Considering the cost of everything, groceries.
Like, rent is outrageously high. A really crappy bedroom in a house that's like falling apart in Boston can easily be like over $1,000 plus like utilities, and it just like goes up every year.
Yeah, wages have been rising, but not nearly enough to keep up with the cost of an apartment and a lot of other things. Josh Bivens is a research director at the Economic Policy Institute.
Before the Ukraine invasion, I thought in 2022, we were probably going to see wages start to go ahead of inflation, because I thought inflation was going to relent quite a bit through the year. And that's probably been delayed pretty considerably.
Sometimes companies don't raise wages to keep up with inflation because they can't afford to. Their prices are going up too. And sometimes they just don't want to, unless it's absolutely necessary. Luis Castro is a chemist in Houston, Texas, and his company recently offered him a promotion and a 7% raise from $28 to $30 an hour.
So I mentioned to them that if inflation was up by like 7%, then I didn't feel like there was much of a raise at all.
He also showed them the offers he was getting on LinkedIn.
I just opened my phone and showed them, look, these are the emails. If you don't offer me what I'm asking for, basically, I mean, I literally can just email someone and probably walk out today with a new job.
His employer matched his other offers, and then some, bringing his wages to $36 an hour, an almost 29% increase. But he says it was probably the other offers that persuaded them, not the fact that everything is getting more expensive. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
After the weekend freakout that sent prices above $130 a barrel, crude oil has calmed down a little bit the past couple days, $110 or so a barrel now. Gas, though, still high. I would tell you what it is today, but honestly, it's going up so fast, might be out of date by the time you hear this. One sector, though, that could actually benefit: public transit. City buses and trains have seen huge drops in ridership during the pandemic, and even with some people headed back to the office, The American Public Transit Association says demand for transit is still just 62% of what it was in the before times. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has that one.
The main thing that got Peter Robison out of his car was the hundreds of dollars he spent on parking in downtown Nashville. Now he takes the bus.
Last year, I finally really made the full switch over.
With gas prices so high, he's feeling pretty good about that decision.
I don't want to say the word smug, but I'm very much insulated from the rise in prices.
Public transit could soon see more riders like Robison, says Chandra Bhatt, who studies travel behavior at the UT Austin School of Engineering.
When we want to try to move people from driving alone to transit use, car use disincentives tend to work better.
Disincentives like $4 a gallon gas. A few big city transit systems, including DC's Metro and San Francisco's BART, have already seen slight increases in ridership since the beginning of March. Bobby Cisneros with Albuquerque's transit department says this is an opportunity to entice riders who got used to driving more during the pandemic.
In the current situation that we're in with gas prices rising, you know, we get out and we want to remind folks that there's ways to save money. One of those ways is to jump on our bus.
And he says the city is locked into a fuel purchasing contract through the end of June. So for now, at least, it's not paying out the nose to fuel up its buses. But not everyone has the option of turning to public transit, says Yona Freemark with the Urban Institute.
The majority of Americans live in places where transit access is really poor.
He says these high fuel prices won't last forever, but the issues they raise will keep coming up.
And so we need to give people reliable public transportation options.
Freemark says low-income Americans and folks living outside of major cities feel it the most when transportation costs are high. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, calm, mostly. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a slice of the economic impact of the war in Ukraine that hasn't really been at the front page of news coverage yet, but will surely be as time drags on. According to the United Nations World Food Program, 60% of people who are food insecure on this planet live in areas affected by war, and this war could have disproportionate impact. Ukraine and Russia, as we've told you, are both huge grain exporters, 25% of the world's wheat supply, as we've told you, edible oils as well. 80%, something like that, of sunflower oil. So we've gotten Dr. Arif Hussein on the phone. He's the chief economist at the World Food Program. Thank you, sir, for coming on.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
People heard up in the introduction the number of staples of wheats and grains and oils that come from Russia and Ukraine combined. It occurs to me, though, that Ukrainian farmers this year, they're fighting. They're not farming. And if they don't get the crop in the ground, that is not a hole that can be made up.
Well, it's going to be really, really tough because, so if we take these two countries together, they supply the rest of the world with about 30% of wheat, with about 20% of corn, with about 80% of vegetable oil, like sunflower oil. So it's big. Now, on the wheat side, what is happening is that wheat is already in the ground. So on the corn side, corn will be planted pretty soon or needs to be planted pretty soon. But above all, I think the issue is that even if it is sitting there, how is it going to come out?
Yeah.
If no ships are going into the Black Sea, just because they don't want to take that risk or the insurance premiums are so high, there could be millions of tons sitting there, but if they're not coming out, they're of no use to the rest of the world, right?
So look, you've been dealing with this for a long time, right? Your whole professional life and the pre-existing conditions, if you will, of the pandemic and costs and inequality are not new to you. The war obviously is. So I'm going to guess somewhere the World Food Program has a plan for what to do in case of a war. But what are you going to do? Because this seems to me to be an insurmountable problem.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, you know, it's always good to look back in history, right? So one of the questions people were asking me were, you know, we've been here before, as in, you know, food and fuel crisis of 2008, mm-hmm. or then again in 2011, you know, the start of Arab Spring. So how does this compare to that? And I was like, again, I was like, it's worse. It's like, worse. Why is it worse? You didn't have a war in Yemen. You didn't have a war in Syria. You didn't have a war in Ethiopia. You didn't have a war in Northeast Nigeria. You know, Afghanistan was what it was. In terms of our plan, of course we have a plan. As we speak, we need to help in 2022 about 145 million people around the world. And the bill to actually do that, the resources needed to actually do that, before this crisis were upwards of $18 billion. After this crisis, they're upwards of $20 billion. Ask me how much of that we have in our pocket right now, or likely to be secured right now. It's less than 50%.
Which is kind of amazing because, and this is going to sound ridiculous, but that's just not a whole lot of money.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, here's the thing. When you look at the big picture, you know, it's all almost like, you know, if something happens, if you get sick and it is treated right away, you know, you may sort it out within a matter of days and not really spend a whole lot of money. But if you let it fester, it becomes a bigger and bigger issue where you may even lose a limb, right? We are in that kind of space. When we don't sort these things out early, we end up paying 1,000 times more for that problem.
Dr. Arif Hussain is the chief economist at the World Food Program, run by the United Nations. Dr. Hussain, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai. Really appreciate being here.
All right, a little bit more now on the humanitarian crisis this war has brought. When you hear the phrase humanitarian aid, what comes to mind? Boxes of food, probably. Blankets and tarps being handed out, maybe from the back of a truck. Tents where there's health care for the refugees who need it. And in and around Ukraine, those things are happening for sure. But a lot of organizations are just handing out money, too. That's something that was actually first done more than a century ago. And as Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports, aid groups have again realized that in an emergency, sometimes the most useful thing can just be cold, hard cash.
Since it was formed in the 1930s, the International Rescue Committee, or IRC, has learned a lot about how aid works and doesn't work.
When we give people blankets or plastic sheeting, what we often have seen over the years is that people just sell them and get cash.
Bob Kitchen is with the IRC, which is working now to help people affected by the Russian invasion of Ukraine. He anticipates up to half its budget there will be used to give to refugees directly. That's tens of millions of dollars.
And just giving them the cash enables them to make their own decisions.
Kitchen says it's more efficient that way and also helps the local economy.
Giving vendors the opportunity to make money and they pay their staff. And there is a virtuous cycle of investment when we give people cash.
Of course, in order for all this to work, there have to be local vendors who are selling things that people need. Gabrielle Araba is with UNICEF, which is planning to put $150 million towards cash assistance in Ukraine. He says the group keeps an eye on local economies.
We do monitor the markets, both of goods and services, to make sure that we can quickly adapt and scale up on the supply side in case we see that markets become dysfunctional.
Araba says UNICEF uses a global database to ensure aid is going to the right people. That's a long way from one of the earliest known examples of cash assistance.
Clara Barton used it. She was the founder of the American Red Cross.
Kirsten Gelsdorf is director of global humanitarian policy at the University of Virginia.
She used cash relief as part of the Franco-Prussian War response in 1870.
But it's only really taken off in the last 20 years. Dan Maxwell studies aid as a professor at Tufts. He says cash assistance was first used on a large scale in 2005, following the tsunami.
Primarily because there was so much cash donations that people didn't know what else to do besides just give it to the victims of the crisis.
Now, in Ukraine and surrounding countries, aid agencies are still figuring out exactly how to distribute direct assistance, i.e. whether it'll be actual cash or some form of digital transfer or debit card.
Visa and MasterCard both have big initiatives to be the actual conduit.
And there's a potential upside for credit card companies and banks that get involved. The refugees they help could eventually become long-term customers. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we could start supplying Europe.
Gas, gas, and more gas. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, here you go. On a Thursday, Dow Industrials down 112 points, 0.3%, 33,174. The NASDAQ gave back about 125 points, 0.9%, finished at 13,129. The S&P 500 off 18 points, 0.4%, closed at 42.59. Told you it was mostly calm. Amazon jumped 5.4% today after the online retailer announced yesterday it would do a 20-for-1 stock split. Also, and not coincidentally, approved a $10 billion share buyback. Goldman Sachs down 1.1% after announcing it's closing its businesses in Russia. A new survey from the Pew Research Center shed some light on the great resignation, the high rate of Americans quitting their jobs during the pandemic. 63% of respondents cited low pay and the lack of advancement opportunities. 57% cited feeling disrespected at work. Bond prices down. Yield on the 10-year T-note up to 1.99%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. After a long and not-so-glorious track record of kind of trying but not really succeeding at going after Russian oligarchs with assets throughout the UK, this morning the British government targeted 7 of them, including Roman Abramovich. We've talked about him a time or two. He owns the Chelsea Football Club and has been trying to sell it before it gets taken. That sale is now on hold. President Biden called out the oligarchs in his State of the Union speech. The federal government has set up a task force to go after them. France has seized a superyacht. The EU's got its list. And Japan is freezing oligarchian assets as well. But who are these guys? Because they are almost all guys. Where are they and what do they do and where did they come from? How much money and power do they really have? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore got that assignment.
Money and power. That about sums up an oligarch, says Jeffrey Winters, political scientist at Northwestern.
This is a term that goes back actually thousands of years. A lot of people think that oligarchy refers to rule by the few. But when you look into it, it always meant rule by the wealthy few.
And Russia's oligarchs are definitely wealthy.
You have to have a palace of at least $100 million.
Anders Oslund is a senior fellow at the Stockholm Free World Forum and author of Russia's Crony Capitalism.
You have to have a yacht of at least 100 million. The biggest oligarchs have yachts of $600 million. And of course, you have a private jet. All the decent oligarchs have these three things.
The original Russian oligarchs got their start in the 90s, says Jeffrey Winters.
When the Soviet Union broke down, there were enormous number of state owned assets and corporations and financial institutions, and a very small set of well-connected, smart, ambitious people basically grabbed those assets.
In oil, in gas, in finance, they became powerful. And when Putin became president, he had to break that power.
Eventually, that also involved putting some of them in jail.
At the same time, Putin groomed a newer, different kind of oligarch, one whose wealth came from Putin and the access he granted to the coffers of the Russian state. Matthew Schmidt is associate professor of national security at the University of New Haven. He says it would work something like this.
You would have a government deal and you would inflate your prices.
You would get overpaid by, say, $500 million, he says.
the main oligarch would keep, $300 million and then would use the other $200 million to dole out money to other people, including Vladimir Putin. And that was the deal. And that's how everybody got rich.
Some oligarchs were Putin's friends from his KGB days or his days as a deputy mayor of St. Petersburg. Whoever they were, their fortunes and sometimes their lives now depend on Vladimir Putin.
It's that litmus of loyalty that really is the key ingredient to an oligarch's wealth.
Heather Connolly is president of the German Marshall Fund.
Mr. Putin can create it and Mr. Putin can take it away.
Connolly spent years researching the Kremlin's economic behavior and says the oligarchs' dependence on Putin limits the effectiveness of sanctions targeting them.
We actually saw a little of this in 2014 after the annexation of Crimea. The oligarchs understood the loyalty test and many of them drew even closer to the regime.
Drew even closer to the regime despite sanctions. And in any case, she says, oligarchs have spent small fortunes on hiding their large fortunes around the world. Schmidt at the University of New Haven is also dubious about the impact of oligarch sanctions.
These people, they're interested in more than just money. They're interested in many cases in the same vision that Putin has for this sort of manifest destiny of Russia. And so there are many of these men that think to themselves, this is a good investment of my money to make this future Russia.
In other words, you can freeze a bank account. It's much harder to freeze an ideology. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The list of the ways in which the Russian invasion of Ukraine is changing things, be those things geopolitical or economic or humanitarian or logistical, now includes environmental. The Brits seem to be set to reconsider their fracking moratorium. The UK's first exploratory shale gas wells were shut down back in 2019 and were expected to be filled with concrete as early as next week. But then came war and Russian gas and Europe depending on it for as much as 40% of its natural gas supplies. And so now London says it's going to keep a fracking open mind. And those wells up in the north of England are probably going to stay open too. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that one.
Lawmaker Craig McKinley is leading the parliamentary campaign to lift the moratorium on fracking. He says for the Brits to ignore the vast reserves of shale gas under their feet never made any sense.
This is total madness. Just 10% of potential reserves would supply the UK with gas for a full 50 years.
The UK, he says, would no longer need to import gas from continental Europe and could help cut the continent's energy reliance on Russia.
If this really did get off the ground, we could start supplying Europe to get itself out of its own energy mess.
Fracking was suspended here 2.5 years ago after it triggered a series of earth tremors, the worst, 2.9 on the Richter scale. But retired geology professor Ernie Rutter says that's a very minor tremor indeed.
Think of a heavy truck driving along on the road. Think of a train passing by. They're very, very mild degrees of shaking.
The sort of tremor, he says, that's been caused drilling for geothermal energy in other parts of the UK.
People are prepared to accept larger tremors in connection with things that they perceive as clean and green.
The fact that it produces a fossil fuel is one reason fracking isn't popular here. Anyway, say the critics, it isn't the solution to Europe's immediate energy crisis.
I really just don't think that it's a practical possibility.
Professor of Global Energy at Warwick University, Mike Bradshaw, points out that the UK shale reserves are still unproven and...
I just don't think that the industry is capable of developing at sufficient pace to reach a scale of production that would make any material difference to physical security of supply.
The fracking company insists that if the regulations were streamlined and planning approvals rushed through, it could be feeding gas in time for next winter. Lawmaker Craig McKinley claims that a green light for fracking could help end Europe's regrettable financial support for Putin.
Europe is still transferring hundreds of millions of dollars on a daily basis to the Putin regime for the gas that it so desperately needs, and that is a national and international scandal.
The UK government is due to publish an emergency energy review soon. Then we will learn whether UK fracking will play a part in weaning Europe off its dangerous addiction to Russian gas. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which you might not feel it, but the data is what the data is. From the Federal Reserve this morning, this item: household net worth at the end of last year, that is the fourth quarter, October through New Year's, topped $150 trillion, up 14.5% from the same period a year earlier. How come, you ask? Stocks, of course, which means that household wealth in this quarter, yeah, it's probably going to be below $150 trillion because, come on, y'all know the answer, right? Stocks go down, too. Okay, your moment of economic context as we head out the door. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen was on CNBC this afternoon, pointed out that the labor market is strong, growth is good, but yeah, inflation's going to be a problem and is going to be one for a while, especially given the war. Does not think, though, that there's going to be a recession, for whatever that's worth. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Petra, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.